This podcast is a part of Sphera,
a collective of independent media outlets from across Europe.
For more information,
visit sphera-hub.com.
Happy birthday, Katie. For your birthday present, I wanted to give you loads of really stressful European news.
Thank you. What a gift. What have you got for me?
Well, it's just been one of those weeks where I feel like we need to make two episodes because so much has been happening. I've been struggling to keep up. But on Saturday night, I didn't look at my phone for about 4 hours. And then when I opened it, it just felt like everything had happened. The Austrian Chancellor, Sebastian Kurz, had resigned due to a corruption scandal. Babiš, the Czech Prime Minister, who Katie was very sceptical was going to be affected by the Pandora Papers. Seems like maybe he was, and he lost the election just.
I know. I confidently said on this podcast it was looking like a foregone conclusion, not so much.
Yeah, so are you enjoying your birthday week?
Yeah, it's just been really thrilling and calm. No, I am, thank you. And talking to you is a gift, Dominic.
Oh, that's kind of sweet. And one thing I didn't mention was one of the biggest things to happen, which was a court ruling from Poland's Constitutional Tribunal that, in very simple terms, ruled that Polish law overrules EU law. That's quite a shocking thing to happen in the EU sphere. And it's even led some to question whether Poland's membership of the EU might be in doubt. We're going to be diving into that this week, trying to find out what happened and why it happened. And we're going to be speaking to someone whose tweets have been really helping me to understand it a bit better. Someone called Jakub Jarodziewski, a research coordinator at Democracy Reporting International, who will be joining us later on in the show. But first, it's time for You can go first because it's your birthday. Who's had a bad week?
What a privilege. Yes, as aforementioned, I am giving bad week to the wunderkind of Austrian politics, Sebastian Kurz, because he has had to resign as chancellor in the midst of a good old-fashioned scandal. Kurz is facing a criminal investigation into allegations that he masterminded a very dodgy situation a few years ago when his party allegedly used public money to pay for polling data that had been like manipulated to make them look better. And then, also allegedly, they paid a tabloid newspaper called Österreich to write about these dodgy opinion polls, which is not a great look. It kind of goes without saying that producing opinion surveys to make you look better than you are, it's not a very democratic thing to do. And also paying journalists to write flattering things about you is generally not something that should happen in a well-functioning democracy either. So yeah, the authorities have been taking this very seriously. And a bunch of buildings linked to Kurz and his inner circle got raided by prosecutors last week. And he is now under investigation, along with 9 other people.
It really doesn't sound very good. But Kurz does say he's done nothing wrong, right? Because a few days ago, he was refusing to step down.
Yeah, exactly. So Kurz has said, I've done absolutely nothing wrong and my name is going to be cleared. Just you wait. And yeah, as you say, he didn't initially want to step down over this. But in the days after the police raids, the pressure really kept piling on. Thousands of people protested outside his office, calling on him to resign. And he was going to face a vote of confidence if he didn't go. So he's jumped before he was pushed, basically. He has said that he is just resigning for the good of the country because Austria needs stability right now as it climbs out of the pandemic, along with everyone else. And if he didn't go personally, the options didn't look great for his Conservative Party, the People's Party. And they might have had to have a really messy coalition running the country. So he's gone, supposedly for the good of the nation. And he has been very swiftly replaced by a new guy, Alexander Schallenberg, who was the foreign minister until now.
I'm racking my memory, but there was another big corruption scandal around Kurz, wasn't there?
Mm-hmm. You might remember a little scandal called
Ibizagate.
Ibizagate, yes, from a couple of years ago, which, to be fair, was really a party engulfing the far-right party in Austria, who were coalition partners with Kurz, so it wasn't so much his own party. But yeah, that was a very weird scandal where the head of the far-right was filmed talking to this woman who he thought was the niece of a Russian oligarch. And he said all kinds of stuff about how he'd like give her nice government contracts if the Russians helped out in the election campaign. Really wild stuff. So that government of Kurz's collapsed over the scandal. But they had to have new elections as a result. And Kurz actually ended up doing pretty well in those elections because he managed to actually pinch quite a lot of the votes from the people who'd gone off the far right over that scandal.
So presumably there's a chance that he might just bounce back again. Is he going to be another one of these Teflon politicians where everything falls off him?
His hair is quite Teflon. Maybe. Some people might think he might actually carry on putting the strings a little bit behind the new chancellor, because the new guy, Schallenberg, he actually owes quite a lot of his recent career to Kurz. But the other thing is that Sebastian Kurz, we have to remember, is still really young for a former world leader. He was only 31 when he became chancellor. He was the youngest leader in the world at that time. And he's still only 35. So yeah, there's still a few years ahead. He's staying on as leader of his party and he's still an MP. So I don't think this is the last we're going to be seeing of him and his ample supplies of hair gel.
Maybe we should tap him up for our special series, This Is What a Generation Sounds Like, where we speak to young Europeans.
Good idea.
But back to being serious, Kurz, his decline like adds a bit to this feeling that European conservatives are not doing so well right now.
It kind of does, right? It does add to this picture of the centre-left having a pretty good time in Europe at the moment and all of their parties doing well in elections, and the right having a less great time. Merkel's conservatives just got their worst ever results in Germany. The right is looking pretty fragmented in other countries like France and Italy. Kurz himself, he's a really interesting figure because he has previously been held up as a successful example of someone who has done well by co-opting really quite hard right positions, which is a trend that we've seen in other countries, you know, lots of countries, really. Kurz himself was pretty hardline on immigration, especially. He cut welfare payments for asylum seekers. Some of his critics have actually argued that he's not really that dissimilar from someone like Orban in some of his rhetoric. And yeah, he was previously seen as someone who'd been really successful by tacking right, and now he's gone. Does that mean that this trend of right-wing parties shifting even further right is going to stop? I don't think so. I'm going to offer that up as a prediction. But yeah, I mean, who knows? I was wrong about the Czech elections last week. I might be wrong about this too.
I was going to say.
Who's had a good week?
It's been a good week for young people in Spain after the Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, proposed a policy to give Spaniards aged 18 to 35 a monthly €250 bonus to help them move out of their parents' homes.
Woohoo, money!
Yeah, everyone loves money. Sadly, it will only be for 2 years to start with anyway, and you must be earning under €23,725 per year. But frankly, in Spain at the moment, that constitutes quite a lot of young people, sadly. The transport minister estimated that the bonus will benefit about 40 to 50,000 young people.
Okay, sounds like a potentially interesting idea. But the context to all of this is there is like really high youth unemployment in Spain, right?
Yes. And yeah, I'm going to try and not make this just a long list of statistics, but some of the statistics are really important. So bear with me. So currently youth unemployment is at around 38% in Spain, according to Eurostat. And to give that number a bit of context, the average youth unemployment rate for the whole of the European Union is much lower. It's around 17%.
Oh, wow. Quite a big gap.
Yeah. And amongst the young people who are fortunate enough to have a job, over half of them have temporary contracts. And their average wage is not so high in Spain. For young people, it's €970 per month. And that's often not enough to live on unless you stay living with your parents, especially if you live in a big city like Barcelona, where you can be expecting to pay something like €800 to €1,000 per month on rent. Mm. And that's why so many young Spaniards end up living at home with their parents in their 20s and actually even into their 30s. I'll try and make this the final statistic, but this one really captures the situation and I think will surprise a lot of people outside of Spain. The average age that Spaniards leave home is at 30 years old. That's 4 years later than the EU average of 26 years old.
That is a lot of time living with your parents. Jeez.
Yeah, and it's not always terrible living with your parents. I had a nice time living with my parents until I was 26. I'm very average.
You're at your parents' house right now, aren't you?
I am, and it's very nice to see them. But it's also nice to have like an independent life of my own and a house and to start feeling a bit like an adult in my 30s.
So obviously housing has been in a pretty crappy situation worldwide. It's not just in Spain, but has the situation been getting worse in Spain for housing?
Yes, like almost everywhere else, it's been getting worse in Spain. You know the drill. And it's especially bad in Spain because incomes have been falling, unemployment rising, rental prices have been rising, and finding available properties has become more and more difficult as the number of available properties on the market have decreased. And interestingly, the majority of the Spanish population owns rather than rents. But yeah, that doesn't make it any easier for the many young people who can't afford to get on the property ladder or even find a place to rent.
Mm.
And this policy to give a bonus to some young people for up to 2 years is not the only remedy that the Prime Minister is proposing. It's part of a wider package of policies to improve access to housing in Spain. One policy is to increase taxes on people who own houses but leave them vacant. Another, probably the other most attention-grabbing policy, is a proposal to introduce a new rent control policy for landlords who own more than 10 properties. As we've discussed before on the show, rent control is becoming like quite a hot political topic in various parts of Europe.
Yeah, there was all that drama over it in Sweden, just to give one example.
Yes, there was. It's not clear yet if these Spanish policies will have an easy ride. It first needs to be approved by the cabinet when they meet this week, and then it would need to be voted on by parliament. But due to the way things work in Spain, some of the main parts of the bill, the rent control and higher taxes for owners who leave their properties vacant, they can't be enforced nationally. They have to be enforced by the local authorities. And the popular party, the main opposition party to the government, they quite strongly oppose these new laws, describing the package as suicidal interventionism. And they've said that they would not enforce these laws in the parts of the country that they are in power.
Aha, okay. And how much of the country is that?
It's a significant minority of the country. They're in charge in 5 regions of Spain and 4 of the major cities. So residents in places like Madrid, Andalusia, Galicia, for example, will be unlikely to see the rent control and higher taxes for vacant properties. In any case, we're going to be keeping an eye on it. And the proposal to help young people move out of home seems like it definitely constitutes good week for at least some young people in Spain. There will, of course, be many people for whom this is by no means enough to help them move out of home. For the 38% who are unemployed, €250 is very unlikely to be able to touch the sides. But for some people, I'm sure it will be the thing that makes the difference between having to stay living with their families or being able to start their own independent life. So good week for young people in Spain.
We have a lovely bunch of new Patreon supporters to thank this week.
Thank you to Anna Negresco, Adrian Murphy, Effie, Dan Chen, Nikolai G, Nick Higgins, and also Valerie Vargo for increasing her pledge.
It is thanks to lovely people like these ones that we are able to carry on making this podcast. And if you would like to also help us carry on making this podcast into next year, we would be hugely, hugely grateful for any donations, big and small. You can sign up at patreon.com/Europeans Podcast. And receive a range of fun and sometimes weird rewards.
If you don't have any money to support us at the moment, we'd really appreciate a review on Apple Podcasts if you're still using that platform. It can help people find us and doesn't cost you any money, just a little bit of time.
Thank you.
Needy section over.
Let's be honest, Poland was a pretty strong contender for bad week this week. You've probably seen some headlines talking about a possible Pole exit, a Polish exit from the EU. And you've probably seen that it has something to do with a court ruling, a very controversial court ruling by the Constitutional Court in Poland. If you haven't managed to grasp any more than that, you could be forgiven because, let's be honest, most of us are not constitutional lawyers and this stuff is confusing. We'll get to this week's developments in a minute, but just to give you a quick recap of the context, this whole thing is part of a fight that has been going on for years between Poland and the EU over really basic questions of how democratic institutions operate. And a huge part of that is that the right-wing ruling party in Poland, Law and Justice, they have been reforming the courts in really disturbing ways that make them much less independent than before and much more political. So the court that made this ruling, it itself is stacked with judges who are friendly with the ruling party. It is a puppet court. This isn't the only thing causing tensions between Warsaw and Brussels. There is, of course, also this frankly horrific strain of homophobia running through government discourse, and a lot of tensions over the media and the way that the media is increasingly turning into propaganda in Poland. So that is all the backdrop to what some legal experts are calling the greatest constitutional crisis in the history of the EU. The Polish court has basically said there are elements of the EU's treaties that we don't think are compatible with our constitution. And ultimately what it means is that there could be cases where an EU court could say Poland has to do X, and Poland could turn around and say, no, we're not doing that because we don't recognise your authority. And that creates an extremely messy situation, because this idea that EU law trumps domestic law is a fundamental principle of how the EU operates. And that is why you've been hearing people talk about some kind of a legal polexit over the past week. It's just like the system doesn't compute this. What on earth are we supposed to make of all this? Well, this week we have the good fortune to be speaking to someone who is really good at explaining a lot of this stuff. He has been one of the best people at explaining what is going on in Poland right now. Two Anglophone Twitter users over the past week, Jakub Jaraczewski, Research Director at the think tank Democracy Reporting International. And we gave him a ring in Poznań in Western Poland.
So this whole ruling came about in the first place because the Prime Minister asked the court to rule on the issue of whether Polish law or EU law was supreme. Why exactly are the Law and Justice Party heading so willingly into this head-on collision with the EU?
The support for Poland's continued presence in the European Union is indeed very high. And ruling party would probably not risk anything that could be comparable to Brexit, to triggering Article 50 and formally exiting the European Union. However, at the same time, the support for the changes to the Polish judiciary and the views on the backsliding of the rule of law have more or less fallen across the party lines. The people who support the government are fine with those changes. The people who support the opposition are mostly against. This means that when it comes to this particular slice of actions on the rule of law, the government enjoys far more support and has taken political risks, including the one that they did last week. This move will probably not in any way lead to a polexit meant as an exit of Poland from the European Union. There is simply no political will for that in Poland, and the EU member states do not have the ability to eject one of their own out of the bloc. There is no mechanism for that. However, what the last week's situation risks is isolating Poland legally and potentially leading to exclusion of Poland from various mechanisms of judicial cooperation within the European Union. Hence the talk about a legal polexit, a kind of a partial setting Poland outside of EU's legal sphere. And this is something that the ruling party seems apparently being ready to risk.
But on the flip side, there's also this question of money in the background, right? Poland is supposed to be getting tens of billions of euros from the EU COVID recovery fund. But it would be quite unimaginable for the EU to give all of this cash to a government that might not even be legally respecting its decisions, right? Surely that is something that the Polish government wants to avoid.
One of the possible explanations for the events from last week is that the Polish government is trying to use the situation as a bargaining chip in its ongoing negotiations with the European Commission. Poland has a big axe to grind with the European Commission. The European Commission has halted the approval of Poland's COVID-19 recovery fund plans and thus also halted payout of the money. It has also launched several infringement procedures against Poland, and those procedures are now at the stage where the Court of Justice of the European Union may pass out financial sanctions against Poland. And also hanging in the background is the rule of law conditionality mechanism, which links payout of EU funds to respecting the rule of law. And on all those counts, the Polish government is negotiating with the Commission. The last week's actions might be just that, a play in this game, an attempt to strong-arm the European Commission into caving in to Polish position or demands. But we've seen the European Commission toughen its stance in Poland in the recent months. We've seen far stronger action than it happened before. So it is also entirely likely that the Polish government could have overplayed its hands, and the European Commission will not blink in this situation, leading to, well, a very unsuitable situation for the Polish government if this money won't start flowing.
Right now, as we speak, there is this court case going on at the EU Court of Justice where Poland, along with Hungary, are trying to strike down this measure that would allow the EU to, in specific circumstances, only give out their cash on the condition of certain requirements around the rule of law. How do you think that's going to play out? Do you think there's any chance Poland could get their way in that case?
I believe that the chances of the Polish and Hungarian governments to have the Court of Justice side with them are very low. The arguments are flimsy, and the agreement from EU member states on the interpretation of this mechanism is kind of anonymous, apart, of course, from Poland and Hungary. I think that what those two countries are doing is that they are stalling and playing for time, hoping that the actual triggering of this mechanism of the use of the rule of law conditionality will be delayed and hopefully done as late as possible in order to allow those countries to use EU money without interruption and without having to worry about the rule of law. Frankly, I think it's more of a problem of Hungary currently due to the fact that Hungary has long-standing problems with the way it uses EU funds. There have been investigations into corruption, and there have been a lot of talk about how the closest allies and family of Prime Minister Orbán are benefiting from EU funds. In Poland, the situation has been not as bad when it comes to use of EU funds. Poland is a country with a very good reputation for disbursing EU funds correctly and not leading to any corruption or irregularities. But even if this money is being used properly and lawfully, there is always the advantage that the Polish government has, that it can use the EU money for one thing and the domestic budget for other political motivated actions.
Quite a few people, rightly or wrongly, have been drawing comparisons between what has just happened in Poland and a ruling by Germany's Constitutional Court last year and saying, well, you know, Poland isn't actually the first country to say that its laws are supreme over EU law. How is this different from the German ruling?
The German ruling was about a really tiny slice of EU law and policy. The bond buying scheme of European Central Bank, well, it's important, but it's quite an esoteric part of EU law and activities of the European Union. While the Polish judgment attacks the very core, it talks about the primacy of EU law and it talks about the relationship between domestic law and EU law in general. It's very difficult to compare those two events. So we've seen a pattern of authorities in Poland cherry-picking decisions of constitutional courts in other EU member states and lifting small parts of them to show that, oh, we're just one more country that's doing this, and we are simply fitting into a pattern of dialogue between national courts and the European Union.
You were out marching on the streets this weekend, protesting against the ruling and supporting Poland's continued membership of the EU. What did it feel like to be out there with all these people pushing back together against the tribunal and against the government?
The thing is that I have never protested in my life as much as I did in the recent 3 years. And from an escalation of conflict on the Supreme Court in Poland through the abortion ruling, there's been plenty of opportunities to take to the streets. I felt, of course, very happy to see all those people out there. I was very happy to see all the flags of the European Union. I also saw that still, as it was the case with other protests related to the rule of law, there were mostly middle-aged and elderly people protesting. For the young, it seems that this issue does not capture their imagination as much as it did with the abortion case, with the abortion protests. There were far more younger people in the streets, and I would say that with the abortion protests also, the cut through the Polish society with all the age and economic groups represented was far more broader. When it comes to the rule of law, it's still mostly the people who are fully aware of the advantages the European Union gives them and also fully aware of the long-term damage that could be done by the government protesting. So it was happy to see them, and it was happy to see also a lot of people come out in Warsaw. But I also think that the government and the ruling party are aware that those protesters are pretty much those people who were against them to some degree anyway, and that this is not breaking any major new ground when it comes to who in Poland cares about the rule of law and who thinks that this is an issue that doesn't affect them at all.
I really mean it when I say that Jakob's Twitter feed is an excellent resource for trying to figure out what's going on in Poland right now. Not just what he posts himself, but also in terms of like things that he retweets, interesting things from other people, not just about Poland, but Central Europe more widely. So go follow him. The link is in the show notes. isolation inspiration time. We're still weighing up what the title of this segment should be. We've had lots of suggestions over the past week. Listener Sonia suggested books and films that help your brain stay good, which I quite like.
Yeah, and there have been some votes for just keeping it as it is, because we all feel isolated sometimes.
That's true. We also had lots of suggestions along the lines of your recommendations, where your is spelled E-U-R, but this is the radio, so you can't hear that. We're still workshopping it. But what have you been enjoying this week?
Well, my isolation inspiration is very fitting for the place that I'm sitting recording right now, which is in my parents' house, recording in a room where I can actually see Alexandra Palace, which is a 19th century kind of originally a people's palace that's now a sports and entertainment venue. And this weekend, it will host a brand new awards ceremony. Who doesn't love an awards ceremony? Well, actually, a lot of people hate award ceremonies. But this one is pretty difficult to hate. It's called the Earthshot Prize, and it's an award ceremony to celebrate solutions for the most important environmental challenges facing our Earth. It's been launched by the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, which is Kate and Wills to you and me. And five of the nominees from all over the world will be winning £1 million each.
Whoa.
They each have ingenious solutions for our very sickly planet. There are some really great and inspiring ideas out there, and it's always good to hear about amazing people who are coming up with incredible solutions. So I will be tuning in, sadly, just on my TV on the 17th of October because I didn't get an invite. But it's going to be streamed on the Discovery Channel's Facebook page or on the BBC if you're in the UK. But yeah, I need to work out how I start getting invited to these things, because especially when they're just down the road, it would be really fun. I'd even be willing to be one of the 60 cyclists who are going to be cycling on static bikes to provide electricity for Coldplay's live performance.
Oh, God, quite a lot of pressure. Because if you like slow down for a second, the guitars lose power.
Yeah, I guess it's motivational music. It'll keep you going. Anyway, what have you been enjoying, Katie?
Well, actually, it's on a similar theme. And my pick comes from one of our listeners, Tobias Hagedorn Rasmussen, who I think is in Iceland. And it is a book called On Time and Water. And it's by the Icelandic writer Andri Snæer Magnusson. It is a book about climate change. But if you're thinking, ah, you know, I can't deal with the climate apocalypse right now, I should stress that this book is not all doom and gloom. It does have a little glimmer of hope in it. It was a huge bestseller in Iceland, and it got released in English last year. And Andri also did a short TED Talks video on YouTube, actually. So maybe I'll post a link to that too.
My grandparents, they were glacial explorers at times when the glaciers seemed eternal. They went on a glacial honeymoon in the year 1956. For 3 weeks, they were mapping and traveling Vatnajökull, Europe's biggest glacier, sleeping in tents in extreme temperatures. And I asked them once, "Weren't you cold?" And they said, "Cold? We were just married."
One of our other listeners, Allegra, said that she read On Time and Water in Italian and also really enjoyed it, especially the way that he writes about Icelanders and their relationship with the water. So it has the seal of approval of our Patreon Facebook group.
Great, we'll have to get it then.
Maybe you could buy it for me for my birthday.
Oh yeah, I thought I'd already given you loads of news for your birthday. Is that not enough?
Bad present, buy me a book.
It's happy ending time, and the story that cheered me up this week was a piece of really encouraging medical research from a group of scientists at Emory University who have discovered that a molecule found in the leaves of the European chestnut tree has the power to neutralize dangerous drug-resistant staph bacteria, aka MRSA.
Oh, that stuff's bad, isn't it?
It is really bad and kills a lot of people, and one of the loveliest things about this piece of research is that it was inspired by traditional Italian folk medicine. The project's been going on for over a decade now, and it's led by an ethnobotanist called Cassandra Quave, whose team conducted interviews with hundreds of people in rural southern Italy looking at traditional medicinal treatments. And she says that in traditional medicine, a compress of the boiled leaves of the chestnut tree is applied to the skin to treat burns, rashes, and infected wounds. And her team have tirelessly worked to discover why this treatment was used and whether it is actually effective and specifically whether it's effective against this drug-resistant bacteria, which apparently it is. And they've now identified exactly which molecule it is in the leaf that does the neutralizing of the bacteria. So they are laying the groundwork for really exciting new strategies to treat this terrifying bacteria based on some very old traditional strategies. And I found that pretty cheering.
We have a special episode in the oven. It's cooking, ready for next week. Is that a bad metaphor? I feel like if it stays in there for a week, it'll be like burned, and that's bad.
Well, considering it's about global heating, then maybe it is quite an appropriate metaphor.
You're right. Anyway, what I'm trying to say is that we have a special episode coming next week, full stop. And we're really looking forward to it. So look out for that in your feeds next Thursday. In the meantime, where can people find us on the internet, Dominic?
They can find us on Twitter at Europeans Pod, Instagram at Europeans Podcast, or on Facebook by typing in the Europeans Podcast.
This episode was produced by me and Wojciech Oleksiak. Our senior producer is Kat Laszlo. We are part of the Are We Europe family, which also makes some other continental flavoured podcasts. Find out more at the link in the show notes.
See you all next week, everyone. Żegnaj.
Pa pa.